Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a real pleasure for me to serve on behalf of the English and Journalism Departments to welcome you here tonight, and to on behalf also of the Alaska Council of the Arts and University Statewide Services. Mrs. Peterson has quite a group of sponsors here tonight. Mrs. Peterson is a very successful writer with 13 books published. She admitted to me last night that she had another 7 or 8 kicking around, at least 1 or 2 of which she hopes to sell. And these books have run into sales of approximately 10,000 copies each, which is about 130,000 copies of books, which is quite a record, I think, for an Alaskan author. Mrs. Peterson was born in Utah and graduated from high school in Salt Lake City. She went on to take a business course and then decided she wanted to get an education. She went to college and dropped out after 1 quarter. She said it wasn't for her. She was bored stiff. And I was reminded this morning when I heard George Nightingale, is it Nightingale? George, whatever his name is on the radio. He said that George Westinghouse quit Union College at the age of 19 because he said that he didn't have the time to give his mind to his studies. He later held 361 patents and founded 60 companies. So perhaps a dropout is not all a bad thing. Mrs. Peterson eventually went to San Francisco, where she worked as a secretary and bookkeeper, and met her husband and came to Alaska in 1943. Then she, on the homestead, she began writing and wrote some fiction articles, some short stories, and began selling them, and finally she sold a book. And after the book, she decided she'd better learn to write, so she took a correspondence course from University of Chicago. Maybe this is a bad way of putting it, but anyway. She, of course, has been writing ever since and publishing. Her most recent book, as you may have heard, is the book on Alaska for the Coward McCann series of States in the Nation. The Newsminer today had it wrong, and it's all my fault. The Newsminer also said she was going to speak next week. In the second paragraph, it says, going to speak tonight. So I hope that not too many people have missed her because of the misprint. She is now turning more and more to nonfiction and is writing now a story or a book on Alaska and her current problems and what her people are doing to solve them. Mrs. Peterson is, I think, one of Alaska's most successful authors. She has won several awards, including, I'll have to let her tell me what they are because I can't find my notes on that, which is very bad manners. But at any rate, it gives me a great pleasure to present to you Mrs. Elsa Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Bedford, and ladies and gentlemen. This is the second time I have stood on this stage. I was here on a similar program last year, and I'm very glad to be with you again. Before I say anything else, I want you to know that I don't consider myself the last word on how to go about writing. This is a very personal affair, and everybody has to do it the way they can work it out for themselves. And all I want to do is perhaps give you a few tips that will be of help to you. Sinclair Lewis was once asked to give a talk similar to this, and he very grudgingly consented. He walked out on the stage and said, "So you all want to be writers, then why aren't you home writing?" and turned around and left the stage. I won't be that terse, and perhaps I can tell you something that will be of interest and of value to you. Writing is a personal affair. There are no set rules. I can only tell you some of the things that have worked for me, and maybe someone will benefit from them. If only a single person here benefits from what I have to say, I will feel well rewarded. This program, as Mr. Bedford told you, is jointly sponsored by the Alaska State Council on the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts of Washington, D.C. It is a continuing program, and this is my second year on it. Are writers born or made? In other words, can one be taught to write? Is it a question of inspiration or perspiration? This is a matter of opinion. Catherine Ann Porter said, "Writing cannot be taught, but only learned." It is my personal opinion that talent is God-given, but the fact that you are interested in writing will probably indicate that you have some talent and that it can be developed. There are many people who have talent, but it is those who work at it who succeed. The reason I am here is not to tell you how to write, but how to go about writing. Why become a writer anyway? One reason is that you have something to say that people will pay to read in book form or in magazine form or even in comic books for that matter. The second is strictly an ego thing, to leave some kind of record that you have lived. I must admit that it is a great satisfaction to me to have published books that I know will endure after I am gone. Perhaps they won't be read anymore, but in some bookcase in the Library of Congress, there is a record that Elsa Peterson lived. And the third reason is to put to use your God-given talent, which, as the Bible says, will be lost if you don't use it, to do something creative to justify your existence. Stories are written for just one reason, to entertain the reader, and any point that you want to make, any message that you want to put across, must be within the entertainment framework. This has to be done very subtly. You can't lecture, or you'll be writing a tract rather than popular fiction or articles. A writer is a creator, and as such, you are omnipotent. You are God to your work because you decide the point you want to put across, the way you want your characters to act in order to bring out your results. You must do this in a logical order of cause and effect, very different from what the way life really is. That is very much more orderly than life is. And while stories are written in terms larger than life, they do solve the problems of everyday existence. There is a euphoria of writing well. It's true mind expansion that I imagine some people get from drugs. There is a glow that you get. In fact, sometimes when you read over what you have written, you have the feeling, gee, did I write that? It's a power that comes to you that you have to experience in order to understand. There's an exaltation about it. A writer needs to have, more than anything, a good memory, an almost total recall, particularly to put across the emotions in your characters, emotions that you felt and you remember. This is a curse as well as a blessing, because writing consists of problems, and you are constantly dredging up your past embarrassments and humiliations and installing these emotions in your characters. whether you realize it or not, you are constantly putting part of yourself in what you are writing. I have a very graphic demonstration of this in something I wrote, this Petticoat Fisherman. I was not consciously using myself as a model for this character, the central character in this book. I have never seen the artist. He has never seen me, nor has he ever seen a picture of me. Yet this girl could be myself when I was 16. So without even realizing it, I put some essence of myself into the book that he caught and illustrated the book there with. This fact makes writing the most intimate form of communication, because you are constantly drawing on your own experiences, on your own characteristics. You are revealing yourself in your writing. You have to be a filter, strain out the commonplace, extracting the essence of the happening so that a reader will feel that is exactly the way it is. I thought of that myself and should have written it myself. How does one become a writer? My experience is that from the time I was a child, I was hooked on words. I'm a compulsive reader. I can't go down a hall or into a room or down the street without reading every printed word that falls before my eye. I can't pick up a tin can without reading the label. It's an obligation. I can't even step into an elevator without reading that little sign, capacity 6 persons. I know what it says, and yet there is a word, I have to read it. I'm also fascinated by word meanings. It delights me that there is no such thing as a true synonym. Each word has its exact meaning that cannot be replaced by another word. There are couplets of words that demonstrate this. For instance, flotsam and jetsam. These are two words that are often used interchangeably, but there is a difference. Flotsam is debris along the beach or a river that has floated away by accident. Jetsam is something that has been thrown away or has been jettisoned. Now, when you find stuff along the beach, you don't care whether it's flotsam or jetsam, except if it's something valuable, the owner of flotsam still has a claim on it because it floated away accidentally. But jetsam you may keep because it was thrown away. Two other words like this are prone and supine. You often read these in terms of adventure and mystery stories. There's a body. It's either prone or supine, and you probably think, okay, there it is, laying there. But in Alaska, for instance, if you're writing an adventure story and you want to put your hero in heroic terms, his body will be found in a prone position. It's lying on his stomach because he is, till the last breath, he is moving forward, and when he falls on his face. But if he gave up, he laid back to die, he's in a supine position. He's lying on his back. And it is these things in words that are so interesting to me. I started my fascination with words when I was a small child. I well remember that the first time I ever wrote my name, I was so small that I couldn't do it. My mother held my hand as I signed a library application for a library card. In Salt Lake City, they have an excellent library system, and we were lucky enough to live in the neighborhood of a branch library. And from the time I was little, I started reading. My parents did not restrict me in any way. They didn't limit me, nor did the librarians. They let me take out anything I wanted. They felt that my ability would regulate what I read. And this is the way it was. I have never been censored or restricted in any way and have literally read thousands of books. I've programmed myself to write. Writing is the most important thing in my life, and everything else is subordinated to it. In order for this to be so, I have had to exercise a tremendous amount of self-discipline, and this is one of the most important things for a writer to do. Apply the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair. Writing comes first. You have got to put aside a time to write on a regular routine basis, whether it is a half hour, an hour, whether it is once a day, once a week, but whatever schedule you set up for yourself, you must follow that in order to get any production at all. Set yourself a quota, either in hours or in words. I personally try to work 2 hours a day, and in that time produce at least 1,000 words if I'm working on fiction, or 500 if I'm working on nonfiction, the difference being the amount of research you have to do on nonfiction as you go along. The French have a saying, if you abandon art for one day, she will abandon you for three. In other words, if you goof off for one day, it's going to take you 3 days to pick up where you left off, to get yourself organized, to pull yourself together. 1,000 words may not sound like very much. This is about 3 pages double-spaced standard size type paper. Ernest Hemingway wrote 800 words a day. Graham Greene, the English novelist, had a quota of 500, or has a quota of 500 to 750 words a day, which certainly isn't very much, but he works 7 days a week, and he has produced 12 novels, 7 mystery books, 3 plays, 2 travelogues, 2 collections of short stories, 1 collection of essays, 1 volume of verse, plus children's books, film scripts, and a good deal of journalism. And this doesn't count the book that just came out. There's an American writer that has a better production record, Max Brand, who wrote Destry Rides Again and the Dr. Kildare series and a number of other adventure stories. In his lifetime, he wrote 196 novels, 226 novelettes, 162 stories, 44 poems, 56 motion pictures. He published 22 million years, and he died during World War II as a war correspondent at the age of 52. It is people like this who go wild when somebody comes up to them and says, well, someday I'd like to write a book if I only had the time. This is the worst thing you can say to a writer, because a writer has no more time than anyone else. We only have 24 hours in our day, but the thing is, we use our time to good advantage. Now, in contrast to what I have said, I feel that it is a dangerous thing to make your living by writing. I would advise the average writer to heed Samuel Coleridge's advice: never pursue literature as a trade. In other words, if you plan to write good stories, good articles, make your name, earn your living some other way. There are several reasons for this. The main one being that if you depend for your bread and butter on your writing, you're going to play it safe. You're not going to be innovative. You're not going to try to upgrade your work. You're going to keep grinding out what you know will sell. And the second reason is, if you do nothing but write, pretty soon you're not going to have anything to write about. I proved this with my own experience. 3 years ago, my husband retired and we moved back to our homestead, which is 15 miles from the nearest neighbor, and we saw people only very rarely. And I thought, oh boy, now I'm really going to have the time to write. Well, I wrote three manuscripts that were all rejected. And the criticism was, you've lost touch. You aren't keeping up with the modern world. And this is true. The ivory tower just won't work. So many people have here in Alaska have said, oh boy, I'm going to work hard and save my money, and then I'm going out somewhere or to some small town and do nothing but write. And all I can say is, don't do it. Keep with the stimulation of a regular job. Get an interesting job that will provide you with good background material. I did this with my work in the salmon cannery and the king crab processing plant, which is the background of a number of my books. It certainly wasn't a literary atmosphere, but it gave me something to write about. As you probably know, there are a number of American writers who are doctors and a number who are lawyers, and this, of course, is an ideal atmosphere for getting background material. I write, as I said, 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, but I think about what I'm writing for all my waking hours. It's on my mind all the time. One strong rule I have that I urge on everyone is, don't talk about what you're working on. More stories have been talked to death by writers than done to death by editors. Especially in the novice writer, your ideas are so delicate, they are so fragile, that they don't bear handling, they don't bear hashing over. Every time you talk about what you're going to do or what you're working on, you are destroying some of your own enthusiasm that should appear on your paper. And you shouldn't be getting the satisfaction of creation by talking about it, because that vanishes into thin air. You should get your work down on paper. I have a very firm rule about this. My writing is a private affair between myself, my agent, and the editor. In fact, I don't even show my husband my manuscripts. Nobody sees my work. In fact, I'm very outraged if anybody ever sits down at my desk and starts glancing over what is lying there, because I just it's so personal to me that I don't submit my work to anyone. This is the reason that I don't approve of particularly amateur groups that sit around and read manuscripts to each other. I think this is a very dangerous practice. If they're not publishing, or if they've just started publishing, it's like the blind leading the blind. They're not capable of criticizing each other. They're not editors, they're writing. They are creators, and they should not submit their work to the judgment of other creators. In the first place, they're is the matter of professional jealousy. A writer may shoot another writer down because he has a good idea and possibly will conflict with something else. And then the other thing is that writers are not capable of being objective about another writer's work. They always think of it in terms of how they would have written it. And therefore they may downgrade something that is a very good piece of writing, but simply because the writer wouldn't have done it that way himself, he is inclined to be critical. There are exceptions to this. There are certain writers that can work with other writers and help them. Kenneth Roberts got a great deal of help from Booth Tarkington. This relationship is rare, however, and it is something to be entered into with great caution. There are, however, genuine writers' organizations, such as the Authors Guild, whose objectives are to better the lot of all writers through improving copyright laws, enforcing the First Amendment, and getting writers the breaks in postal rates, things like that. These are professional organizations, and as you become a successful writer, it is your duty, it is your obligation to belong to one of these organizations, but they are not critical of each other. They are a group who have come together to better the lot of all writers. I personally belong to the Authors Guild and the Authors League of America, and this is the time of this is the kind of organizations these are. People are constantly asking me, since you have no children, why do you write books for children? One of the reasons is I feel an obligation to pass on the pleasure of reading to others who come after me, since I myself enjoyed reading so much as a child. Also, juveniles and adult mystery and adventure are the only strongly plotted stories in American writing today, and this is the type of writing I do. Then I have another more crass reason. An average good juvenile book will outsell an average novel for one main reason. The best market for juvenile story books is the school libraries and the public libraries. And if the book has any merit at all, kids wear books out. And so juvenile books are reordered a number of times, whereas the average novel will only be bought once. So your royalties, your books stay in print longer, and consequently your royalties last longer. Speaking of books staying in print, when I was a youngster, I was enthralled with the books that were written by Joseph Altschuler, who wrote particularly the Young Trailer series. He wrote 31 books on historical subjects. And I thought, if I can write like he writes, I will be happy. And after I had published a few books, I thought I would like to own some of his books, because I wanted to read them again and see if my childish impression agreed with what I thought of them today. So I went to the used book stores in Seattle, and there are several wonderful ones that are fascinating to explore, but I never could find any of his books. Then one day I was in the book department of Frederick and Nelson, and lo and behold, they are still selling these books. They were published in 1906, and they are still in print. Just imagine the royalties those books have collected. My objective in writing is I want to show life as it really is in Alaska, and I have drawn on my own background for this: homesteading, salmon fishing, crab fishing, the 1964 earthquake, and Alaska history. And I intend to continue in this vein as my own experiences broaden. And also, I am an optimistic person, and I want to impress my readers that life is a wonderful gift and we should make the most of it. One of the important things about writing is you have to believe what you're writing in. You have to believe in what you are writing. I had a graphic example of this in the book I wrote on homesteading. I had something in mind like Louise Dickinson's Rich's We Took to the Woods, something in a light vein of our own homesteading experiences, and I submitted it a number of times. This was before I had an agent. And it was always rejected, and the editorial criticism was, this doesn't sound like it's very much fun. And she put her finger on the sore spot right there, because I truly, in my heart, did not think that homesteading was very much fun. And regardless of how I tried to disguise it, it came out in my work. So you do have to write the truth, no matter how you're trying to camouflage it. I would urge all of you who have been here a number of years to listen to newcomers in their comments on Alaska, because they give you the outside viewpoint, and particularly they see things with fresh eyes, things that we think are commonplace, and they see the novelty of it. They're a very important source for you. Whether we like it or not, there is a preconceived idea of Alaska, and this is the thing that editors are going to base their judgment on, too. They, regardless of what the facts are and the truth are, you have got to write, you've got to remember that you're not writing for Alaskans particularly. You are writing, your greatest market is the other United States, and you've always got to give them the feeling that a tie-in with what you write. It can't be too far out. There's got to be something that they can imagine themselves in, too. Of what does a book consist? There are three parts, according to the way I look at it. The theme, which can be expressed in a few words or one sentence, such as crime doesn't pay, or crime pays, if that's the kind of book. Actions speak louder than words. It's the message you want to put across. The Bible is full of them. The Aesop's fables are full of them. The Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes, these are all themes. You put across your theme by means of the plot, which is the story that you are telling. Your story puts across your theme. Your characters make your story. What your people do determine what the story is. Your characters must act consistently. You can't set up one type of a personality and then to have the climax have him completely change. For instance, if your hero is a compulsive liar, and in the whole story you have never shown one instance that he would tell the truth, and then all of a sudden he tells the truth to solve the problem. This is not consistent. You have got to plant in your story that under a certain set of circumstances he will tell the truth, and then to reveal your climax, those circumstances come about, and in that way your problem is solved. There comes a time when you're writing that you have got to see your work in print. Publish or perish is not only true in academic circles. Sooner or later, you've got to quit throwing your work in that desk drawer and reveal it to the cold, icy scrutiny of an editor. You just can't practice forever. And the trouble with most beginners is that they think that they immediately think of the Reader's Digest or Cosmopolitan or Playboy or the New Yorker to send their work. Personally, I think this is a mistake. I think you must remember that these magazines are the biggest magazine, the biggest markets in the world, and you're competing not only with all the thousands of beginners, but you're competing with the best writers in the world. So it's fine to think big, but it is also a bad thing to invite disappointment. There are hundreds, there are thousands of markets in the United States for writing today. There are 2,500 trade magazines published in the United States. There is a list called Business Publication Rates and Data that lists 2,500 trade publications. This list is available in advertising agencies. I believe it is a monthly list or quarterly and is sometimes available if you can't find it in the library. And these are very good markets and ideal for Alaskans. You could write articles about how equipment is used here in Alaska that is also known outside, how Sears Roebuck has stores in Alaska, JCPenney has stores in Alaska as well as outside, and what their particular problems are. All these things are good things to write about. One thing I would warn against, however, is beware of pay on publication magazines. They have an awful habit of tying up your manuscripts, and it's like dropping them down the well. You never hear about it again. I had a graphic example of this in the old Alaska Sportsman. When I was the secretary to Emery Tobin, he had a big cardboard box under his desk. This was his file of good manuscripts that he was going to use someday. Every time somebody sent something in that he thought was pretty good and would make a good possible article for his magazine, he'd pitch it in this box. Unfortunately, he never went back to it. And it got so that I was reluctant to admit that I had ever worked for the Alaska Sportsman, because someone was always bound to say, I sent something to him 3 years ago and I've never heard from him since. And this is because he paid on publication. If he had had to buy those manuscripts, he would have used them. But knowing that his policy was not to pay until he published them, he hung on to them indefinitely. And I think he's not the only editor. I think this still happens all the time. I would urge you to, even though you send your work to lesser markets, always write the best you can. Don't save your material. Don't think you have such a wonderful idea that you should save it for an article for Playboy instead of putting it in for the Alaska magazine. Because the more you write, the better you get. And what seems wonderful to you now will seem quite ordinary as you get better. So always use your best material on whatever you are working on. When you talk about sending things out, you've always got to face the thought of rejections. As a matter of fact, if a writer publishes a third of what he writes, he can consider himself a success, and the rest is practice. Everybody gets rejected. Ernest Hemingway got rejected. And as an aside, I think it is a tragedy that now they are dragging out Ernest Hemingway's old manuscripts and publishing them. I'm sure some of the things that are being published are things that he wouldn't have submitted himself. And his heirs and literary executors are taking advantage of his big name, that he would be regretful that some of these things are being published because they don't come up to his standard. Taylor Caldwell wrote for 30 years before she ever saw a thing in print. 30 years she had confidence, and she wrote books. And she says now that she is thankful that those early manuscripts were never published, because she would be ashamed of them. It's true that rejections disappoint and discourage, but they should not deter you. Everybody is rejected. One thing, when a manuscript comes back, open it, because there may be some valuable information for you there. I had an experience with my first book that showed me the dangers of casting a manuscript aside unopened. It was Victory at Bear Cove. I had submitted it to a publisher and it was rejected. And by the time it came back, I had heard that Abington is the Methodist publishing house. And since they had published a great many of my short stories and serials, I thought, well, maybe they would be interested in the book. So I sent it out to them, always enclosing the self-addressed envelope and the return postage, which is sort of an admission of defeat, but it's one of the laws of the profession, you must do this. I went to the post office, and here was this big envelope. I was heartsick because it had apparently been rejected again. So I took it home, and I threw it in the corner of the settee and sat down and glared at it while I was eating my lunch. And then I noticed that it had come back by airmail. There was airmail postage on it, and I thought, well, I put in return postage, but not airmail stamps. I didn't want it back that fast. So I opened it, and I found that it had been accepted, and they were just returning it for corrections and revisions. And I later met another writer who dropped into the office, and she told me that she had had a similar experience with a less happy result. She had received a manuscript back. She had sent hers. She was outside, and she sent hers by express. And when it came back, it was so nicely wrapped that she hated to open it, so she just readdressed it and sent it out again. It was rejected, and she did the same thing, just readdressed it and sent it out again. When it came back the third time, she decided she'd better look at it to see if it needed freshening up before she sent it out again. And inside, she found a letter from the first publisher saying that he would accept it if she would make some corrections and get it back by a certain date, a date that had long gone. So she lost out entirely. So if you get manuscripts rejected, open them and look at them. There are various reasons for rejections. There are market fluctuations. Right now, you know, many magazines are going out of print, so the market for magazine articles and stories is drastically diminishing. The fiction market is very poor. My agent tells me, don't send me any fiction. I can't place it at all. And this I attribute to the television influence. I think that television has had a very profound effect on the American culture, an effect that we are just becoming aware of. And the reading habits have particularly changed. People have a reluctance to waste time on fiction. They feel that if they spare time for reading, they should be reading something worthwhile. This doesn't mean that they don't want to be entertained. Articles have to be written in an amusing style that is easy to read also. I boastingly can say that after this, my first book was published, it was rejected once. After that, I had 12 books accepted by the first editor who read them. And this was rather unusual, but it was under unusual circumstances, mainly that during the time that I started writing, the federal government was giving heavy subsidies to schools and libraries to build up their stock. Consequently, the publishers were accepting a lot of material. And then all of a sudden, the subsidies were withdrawn, and this also had an effect on my not being able to sell some of my later fiction. And because the styles have gone out, I'm sure that some of the books that were published would not be acceptable now because the writing is very different. When I go about writing a book, when I start a book, I feel a profound discouragement at the beginning. It seems like such an endless task. My manuscripts have been roughly 60,000 words. And this seems like a long, long hill to climb. Now, the editors are not interested in anything that long in my line. They want 40,000 words, no more. When I start to write, or when I'm thinking about writing, my ideas come from three different sources. Writers say that if you have to ask where you get your ideas, you're not going to be a writer, because there are so many ideas. Ideas about writing are the least of the problem. They're everywhere. They come to me from a character, a setting, or a situation. For instance, Petticoat Fisherman was inspired by a girl I knew in Seldovia who was the deckhand on her father's crab fishing boat. I didn't want to know her well. All I knew was she came to the office to pick up her mail, and it seemed like such hard, dirty, smelly work that she could only be on that boat because she was being punished for something. And I made up the story. I didn't want to know why she was on the boat. It was enough for me to know there was a girl on the boat, and I would figure out the reason. So this was how I started plotting Petticoat Fisherman. Mountain of the Sun was inspired by a setting, the Russian era in Alaska. I was very interested in Alaska history, and so I wrote Mountain of the Sun and also Dangerous Flight on the Russian era. Fisherman's Choice was a situation. I wondered what would happen if a homestead boy was exposed to commercial fishing. I made up this family that had come to Alaska to homestead, and like all homesteaders, they went broke and had to go to town to earn a grubstake. Then when it came time, the boy couldn't find a job in the cannery since he was under 16 and wasn't permitted to work by the child labor laws, so he found a job on a boat. And then at the end of the season, he had to make the fisherman's choice. Was he going back to the homestead with his family, or was he going to become a commercial fisherman? House Upon a Rock was inspired by a situation and also a setting. The setting being the small Alaska coastal towns that suffered so badly from the 1964 earthquake. And the situation being, what did these people do to rebuild? I think about a story for about 6 months before I ever put a word down on paper. Usually I'm working on something else when I get an idea for the new book. This is an incubation process. I mull over it. I consider it from all angles for a long, long time. And then when I finally start writing, getting ready to write, I start considering the characters. Usually my characters are based on real people or a composite of real people. And I do write down the description of my characters. This is a matter of self-defense so that they are consistent. They don't have brown eyes in one place and blue eyes somewhere else. And I use usually family birthdays to keep track of their birth dates. And I assemble and study the background material that I'm going to use. I also keep a diary and have done this for many years, ever since we came to Alaska. Not a journal, but a diary, a record of what actually took place. Just a five-year diary that has a few lines for every year. And I have compiled an amazing amount of valuable information this way. In fact, the Department of Fish and Game has come to me and said, we understand you have a record of when the salmon appeared every year. And when did the herring run start at the head of Kachemak Bay? The Weather Bureau came to me just this past summer and said they were making a report on ice conditions in all remote Alaska areas. When did the ice start and when did it go out at the head of Kachemak Bay? And when did you have your violent storms? They wanted this to see how they were doing on their weather forecasts. I had this information. Another thing I have done is to save a Sears Roebuck catalog once in a while. Not every one, but every 2 years or so. What better source could you have for what the styles are in any particular year? Or what tools are being used? what people are doing, even what they are reading, what records they are playing. All this is right in your Sears Roebuck catalog and is an invaluable source of research material. I also keep a tide book. You people aren't interested in that particularly, but it is a good little reference of what day of what date every day of the week came on, when the sun rose and set, and the phases of the moon. These are all valuable sources of information. Even if you only keep one, it's a good reference. I write approximately 1,000 words a day, as I said. The next morning, I read over what I wrote the day before, make the corrections, and then go on for my daily quota. Then every 10,000 words or so, I go back and read over the whole thing to see if it fits in, if it flows smoothly, and that there are no loose ends, so that by the time I get through writing a manuscript, I've read it many times. Then I put it aside for a few weeks so that I can look at it objectively, correct anything that needs to be corrected, and then I type the final manuscript, original and two copies. I send original and one to my agent. She may retain one or turn them both over to the publisher, depending on the publisher's desires. I still correct as I make the final draft, but there is a danger to this that you get tinkering, that you might make changes that don't quite fit in. Change a word and then find out in the next sentence you've used that word already. So this is a rather dangerous practice and should be used with caution. One thing you must do that I do is make your manuscript look as inviting as possible. Because when you come right down to it, an editor is doing you a favor to read your work, and you want it to be as easy for him to do as possible. Good bond paper, a new typewriter ribbon, and clean type. Be sure that the letters aren't filled in, the O's and the E's and the P's and so on, that it is clear and sharp. Wide margins, double spaced always, the margin space being in the happy event that your manuscript has been accepted, the editor can make notes for you to rewrite or for the printer if it's ready to be set up in type. Don't be freaky. Don't think that you will call special attention to your manuscript by making it look different. This is rank amateurism. Not colored paper, not outside paper, and for goodness sake, don't roll your manuscript. This has been done, and an editor, by the time he unrolls this curly mass of paper, he will be so mad that he won't be able to give a fair assessment of your work. Just remember that you are trying to make it easy for the editor to read your work. If it's 6 pages or less, I fold it twice and send it in a standard big envelope. It is more if it's from 6 to 12 pages, I fold it in half and send it in a manila envelope of that size, 5 by 7. And anything longer than 12 pages, I fold flat with cardboard inside. And I always use first class mail. There is a fourth class mailing privilege for manuscripts, but it gets fourth class handling too. So I feel that it is a good investment to always use first class mail. I mail my work to the to my agent, so there isn't any question of return postage. But if you mail direct to an editor, be sure you enclose a self-addressed envelope and return postage. This even applies to book manuscript. These pouch mailers, you would do well to invest in one of those and enclose that with your book manuscript. I never argue with an editor. If he wants something to be rewritten, I rewrite, because I don't think there has ever been anything written that wouldn't benefit by judicious editing. Unless it is some point that is so vital to what you are writing that it can't be changed, I would never refuse to change it. And if, in this case, if you feel that so much hangs on this point, and you explain this to the editor, he will accept it, but he will usually say, well, put it in some other way. If I can't understand what you're driving at, neither will your reader. So leave that point in, but clarify it. Okay, now you've sent in your manuscript and it's been accepted. Maybe you've done some rewriting. Then the next thing is the contract. This is a standard contract. This is the way it looks. A lot of pages of fine print and spaces left for insertions applying to your particular work. You sign these copies and send them back, and usually as part of the terms of a contract there is an advance included, an advance on royalties. This is just that. It is not a bonus. It is an advance for the money your book will earn. And if you happen to get an advance for more than your book earns, you are liable for this out of your next work that the publisher prints. If he does take another book from you, he will deduct this advance from your next book. So he's not giving you anything. The standard contract usually calls for, in my type of writing anyway, calls for 10% royalty, 10% of the selling price. This book sells for $4.95, say $5, so I get 50 cents for every copy of this book sold. However, since I work through an agent, my agent gets 10% of my 10%, so actually I get 45 cents a copy for the books. Now, this doesn't sound like much, and it isn't. I agree. I feel that the writer is the low man on the totem pole as far as finance goes, and this is also something that the Authors Guild is trying to correct, to get the author a bigger royalty. But after you have sent in your corrected manuscript, the next time you see your work, it will be in galley form. Galleys are long sheets, about this long. They contain three pages printed in a solid column. They have wide margins, and you are to correct the typographical errors or make any editorial changes you want. In your copy is stated what a percent of changes you can make without being charged for this. And when you send it back, the next time you see your book, if you are as remote as I am from the publisher, the next time you see your book, it will be like this. You don't have any control over the illustrations. You have nothing to do with selecting the artist. I tried once, and my suggestion was not accepted because the publisher felt it was too hard to work by mail with an artist. So when you get your book, this is the way it looks. And believe me, there is no thrill in the world like getting your first book, seeing your name in print, smelling that beautiful printer's ink smell, and seeing your deathless prose in a solid form. People once sometimes ask me, what is the gimmick to writing? I have a neighbor who is my enemy now because he wants to write and he feels I'm holding out on him, that I have found some little secret that if I would only pass on, then he too could be a writer. I don't have any tips to pass on except the daily routine that I have emphasized. One other thing, don't stop when you're stuck. If you have a problem in your writing, work it out before you stop for that day, because it'll be a lot easier then than to face this problem in the morning when you probably don't even feel like writing anyway. So don't let a problem hang overnight. I usually make it a point to stop at a point where I'm going to write some action. So in the morning, I can be all gung-ho and get into the swing of the work to carry me over, so that if any other problems develop, I will be in full enthusiasm. Another tip I might give you is my confidence in the subconscious. I make it a point to think about my writing as I fall asleep. And if there are things that are bothering me, somehow during the night, these problems are solved. And so in the morning, I know exactly what to do about them. Another thing that is most important, I would say, is if you don't know how already, learn to type. This is an indispensable skill. It is the only chance you have of making your fingers almost keep up with your thoughts. I know a man who wants to write and he can't type. He sits down and he gets a burning inspiration and he writes like mad, and then the next morning he can't read what he's written. This could be avoided by taking the trouble to learn to type. Even if it isn't perfect, at least you have your past work to as a foundation in a readable form, and it will assist you greatly. I have mentioned an agent, and this is one of the questions that is always put to me. How do you get an agent? I won't kid you, this is a hard thing to do. An agent, an honest agent, makes his money by a commission from what he sells for you. Consequently, he is not willing to invest his time in an amateur's work. He won't take you on until he is convinced that you are going to be a good producer, that you are capable and will continue to write. And the only way you can prove this is by having sold some things yourself. The way I found an agent was after I had had one book accepted. Oh, I tried before. I wrote to several and nobody was interested in me. But after I had had one book accepted, I read in the Writer magazine that there is an association of reputable agents, and they put out a brochure of their membership. And by writing to the Writer's magazine, I got the address, and then I wrote to for this brochure. From the list, I selected three names in very blind fashion. One of the persons I wrote to didn't respond at all. Another wrote and said that he didn't handle juvenile work. The third also was not interested in handling books for young people, but he had a friend who would. And so I wrote to this woman who worked for McIntosh and Otis, and I later found that they were one of the better agencies. So I had a very happy relationship with this woman. However, she retired later, and the woman who replaced her didn't seem to be very interested in me. I couldn't establish any rapport. Now, I've never met any of these people. I have no written contract with them. It's all based on trust. And reputable agents and reputable publishers can be trusted. So now I was looking for a new agent. This time I wrote to the Authors Guild, and they sent me some names of reputable agents, and from them I selected another name, the Paul R. Reynolds firm in New York, and they are now my agents. But this is something that comes later An agent won't make your work any better, but at least he knows the markets and knows where to submit your work. It saves a lot of time, and from anyone living as remotely from the publishing centers as we do, it saves a lot of postage too. When I was in the process of changing agents, I wondered if I should enter into another relationship or if I should try to do it myself. So I wrote to the Authors Guild and asked them if they would submit the question on their next survey. They often survey their writers on various questions, and ask them how necessary it is to have an agent. And the consensus was that the farther you live from New York, the more you need an agent. And I would say that this is true. There are three types of racketeers that prey on writers. One is the dishonest agent, the ones who advertise that they charge a reading fee. An honest agent will never ask you to put out cash. He makes his money on the work he sells. You never have to pay an honest agent. The second type of racketeer, I think, is the phony writing schools. These outfits that say you too can be a writer, as the newspaper reporter said I was going to talk about. These are rackets. If you want to learn something about writing by mail, you would be far better off to take an extension course through some university. You'll get exactly the same kind of information, and it won't cost you nearly as much. If any of you don't know it, the famous writers course costs over $900 if you pay on time. And you are not getting instruction by these famous writers whose pictures appear in the advertisements. You are getting your manuscripts corrected by people who probably don't know any more about writing than you do. So, to my mind, it is a racket. And the third type of vultures who prey on writers are the vanity presses, the presses who charge you to publish your work. They really give you a hard sell. I wrote to several of them to get their advertising information when I was preparing these talks. And I'm on their mailing list and frequently get promotional material from them, even to the extent of a mailing pouch and actually even the gum paper to seal the pouch. They are that eager to make it easy for you to send your manuscripts. And if you read through all this material, you will nowhere find any guarantee that they will help you sell your books. This is one of the main advantages of a trade publisher. They distribute your books. You have nothing to do. You don't get the books and have to sell them or promote them. To my mind, the writer should write, the editor should edit, and the bookseller should sell. Now, supposing you do enter into a contract with one of these vanity presses, then when the book is published, you get all the copies. They send you the whole edition, 3,000 or 5,000 books, whatever you have contracted to sell. So you end up with a library of 5,000 books, all of which you wrote yourself. And what are you going to do with these? That's a lot of books to try to sell. It can be done. If you have a book that has merit, you have a special reason for wanting it printed. Say you wrote a book about Alaska and it would only sell in Alaska. The book From Konyag to King Crab by Yule Chaffin of Kodiak is an example of this. It was a good book, and she wanted to have it printed, even though no trade publisher would print it. She went to a commercial printer and got exactly the same service that a vanity press would give her at about half the cost. And then she got busy and she did sell the book herself and has made a financial success of it. But this goes against the grain of a lot of writers. It goes against my grain. I never carry my books to be sold. I have been asked a number of times, well, why don't you carry your books? Because you could sell them on a tour like this. People would buy everything you had. But as I say, a writer writes and a bookseller sells. The trade publisher, as I mentioned, he not only edits your work, but he arranges the illustration. He has his own sources for selling the book, so you don't have to worry about anything like that. There are about 30,000 books a year published in the United States, and of these, perhaps from 25 to 50 are what might be termed bestsellers. This means that the average writer doesn't make a lot of money, much to their disappointment. The average first book earnings of a writer, the first novel, is about $1,000. Certainly a very low hourly rate for the work that is put in. The Authors League and a survey was made in the Authors League of their own members, who are all professional writers, and of former residents of the McDowell Colony, which is an artist colony, about the earnings of professional writers in the United States. And the result revealed that most writers earn an average of from $3,000 to $4,000 a year from their writing. This certainly isn't much and emphasizes what I said, that the satisfaction of writing, the ego building, the creative part is the most important part of writing for the average writer. It isn't the money. I will be quite frank with you. My average is about $4,000 a year. The most I've ever made in a year is $8,000, and this was in unusual circumstances. That year, one of my books was a Junior Literary Guild selection, and it was also sold in Great Britain, and these were new editions on which I got double royalties then, you see. So that raised my earning that year. But my lifetime average is about $4,000 a year. However, I will quote Samuel Johnson, who said, "Only a blockhead would write for anything but money." I agree. I have never given my work away. I have never published in magazines that pay you in copies only. Now, in professional circles, this is done. In university reviews and so on, people whose career depends on publishing do publish for nothing. But if you are to be a professional writer, you don't like to give your work away. I don't like to give my work away. I have written for a cent a word, but I feel that that the fact that you are paid for your writing is an indication that you are a success, regardless of how little that pay may be. As I mentioned, there are subsidiary ways that books make money for you that I wasn't even aware of. In addition to the Literary Guild and so on, there are also special library editions, special publishers who put out nothing but library books that have extra hard covers. And in this way, you also make extra money for a book that has already been published. There is a responsibility in writing that it behooves all of us to keep in mind. This